Topping the New York Times bestseller list.
The Shack is in the top 40 bestsellers of all history.
Having sold millions of copies since its release in 2007, the novel The Shack has become a publishing phenomenon. Now a feature film based on the influential book is to be released in March of 2017. What theology does the book teach? Should faithful Christians be concerned at its impact on the church? Documentary filmmaker Paul Flynn of Megiddo Films has released his latest work, The Shack, Its Dangerous Theology and Error, in an attempt to answer these questions. To watch this film free of charge, please visit our website at megiddofilms.org. That's megiddofilms.org.
You're listening to Megiddo Radio. Megiddo Radio is a radio ministry of Megiddo Media. For more, visit our website at megiddoradio.com. That's megiddoradio.com.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome. This is Paul Flynn with Megiddo Radio for the 29th of August, 2016. Thank you all for tuning in. On tonight's show, we're going to be talking about Islam. Now, we've talked about Islam before on the show. We've had a guest interview with Richard Bennett, where we dealt with the Roman Catholic Church's relationship with Islam. We've also dealt with the, what I call, and other commentators use similar language, the Islamic invasion of Europe through this crisis in Syria. Now, be that as it may, many of the refugees aren't even Syrian, but be that as it may, this horrible situation that's going on in Syria that has led to, at least the pretext to, the political climate for many, many Muslims being moved across the world, mainly to places like Sweden, Finland, Germany. Been going on for decades in Germany. It's been going on for a long time in Britain. And what has been the result of it? There is what I would call a suicidal view of Islam in the West. Suicidal in a way that a ideology that is antithetical, violent, hates women, not the people themselves. I want to make the distinction between, for example, Roman Catholicism has a blasphemous ceremony, and at its worst points, plotted against, you know, kings and states through organizations like the Jesuits. There's that system, and then there's individual Roman Catholics, like, for example, Lord Acton, who had spoken against the system. So I'm not saying every single Muslim this represents, okay, just to clarify that before I continue. But a regime, theology, and ideology that calls for the total domination of the whole world. Now, one thing I wanted to look at here, when you bring up any criticism of Islam, you're called racist, you're called a bigot, you're called all sorts of names. Why? Because there's no argument for it. And it is amounted to, well, free speech exists, except for when you criticize Islam or criticize Muhammad. There's no place in the discourse for any criticism of Islam, and it is becoming scarily close in the United Kingdom to be made a hate crime through this proposals. Been talked about in various parts of government in the UK about an extremist bill dealing with religious extremists. Now, when you know the background of the British government, and you see that, people like Robert Spencer, Pamela Geller, people who've criticized Islam, have been banned from the United Kingdom because they have criticized Islam and said that it, you know, talks about it's a violent subjugation of unbelievers. And the British government rejects that. So Pamela Geller and people like Robert Spencer are not welcome in the United Kingdom, it appears. However, people like Adam Chider, even though he's been in trouble recently with the law, and other people in the country with extremist ties and all this kind of thing, are allowed to enter. What I wanted to do today was compare the views of Theresa May. Theresa May became Prime Minister there recently after David Cameron stepped down after losing the Brexit vote. Theresa May, in 2014, made a speech to the Conservative Party, otherwise also known as the Tory Party, when she was Home Secretary, very high position. And she talked about terrorism. She talked about Islam. Now, this is the Prime Minister of today, not different from other Western leaders and Western apologists of Islam. Let's play her comments and let's quote some views from past leaders of the West. Okay, so this is the Theresa May speech from 2014. A lot of Islamic websites have been sharing this around. I'll show you the clips in a second and you'll see why.
Thank you very much. Well said, Anthony. I could go into a lot more detail, but instead, I'm going to talk to you about the deadly terrorist threat we face. David Haynes was a tireless humanitarian worker who helped Muslims not just in Syria, but in Bosnia, South Sudan, and Libya. 2 weeks ago, he was murdered by terrorists simply for being British. His murder followed the equally barbaric killings of James Foley and Stephen Sotloff, American journalists who were reporting to the world the plight of the Syrian people. The terrorists who murdered David Haynes like to call themselves the Islamic State. But I will tell you the truth. They are not Islamic, and they are not a state. Their actions have absolutely no basis in anything written in the Quran. What they believe has no resemblance whatsoever to the beliefs of more than a billion Muslims all over the world. And, like all the other Islamist terrorist organizations, they have caused the deaths of many thousands of innocent Muslims.
Okay, so she says this has nothing to do. ISIS and all these other groups, you could pick any of these groups, has nothing to do, nothing whatsoever to do with, and she's got other comments later in her speech. In case anybody's looking at this, this is about 5 minutes, 5.5 minutes into the speech that she made in 2014. And I'm going to skip ahead to the 20-minute mark. I'm going to come back to it in a second. But I just want to look at those comments. Before I do, let's quote somebody. I'm not going to tell you who it is, but think about this, right? In light of a couple of years ago, I think it was 2013, Pamela Geller and Robert Spencer, who would expose Islam, are not welcome in the United Kingdom. Do you think the following comments would be welcome in the United Kingdom? Quote, "It indeed is it evident that Christianity must always exert a modifying influence on man's passions and protect them from the more violent forms of fanatical fever. But the Mohammedan religion increases instead of lessening the fury of intolerance. It was originally propagated by the sword, and forever since its votaries have been subject above the people of all other creeds to this form of madness. He also goes on to state, civilization is confronted with militant Mohammedanism. The forces of progress clash with those of reaction. The religion of blood and war is face to face with that of peace. Luckily, the religion of peace is usually better armed. Who do you think said that? I'm going to quote again from this man in a second. Anybody idea? Any idea? If you said this today, publicly in the United Kingdom or anywhere else, you would be labeled a bigot, a fascist, the most hateful person, and you wouldn't be welcome in the country, going by other people. Who said that? Well, these are the views of Winston Churchill. You might remember him. He was the Prime Minister of England, or Britain, when they were fighting World War II, and praise the Lord that the British won, otherwise we'd probably be all speaking German, and the Americans and the British won. Now, he also said that, now just to give equality, I just want to show it, he says, individual Muslims, he said, may show splendid qualities. Thousands become brave and loyal soldiers of the Queen, all know how to die. So just before I continue with the quote here, he's not saying every single Muslim, or Moslem as he puts it, doesn't serve the Queen or King. You know, a lot of them served in World War II, by the way, and this is kind of what he's talking about, and he's talking about, and this is the man who won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1953, by the way. But anyway, he had first-hand knowledge, because in 1895, he was posted to the northwest frontier of India, now Pakistan, bordering Afghanistan. So he was in the army. So he said, okay, individuals, and we all know this, from a human point of view, like, for all have sinned to fall short of the glory of God, we all need to see we're dead in trespass and sins outside of Christ, and we need a Savior. Christ came not to save the righteous, but sinners. We must see that we are sinners before God. So, you could be Muslim or atheist or whatever else. Outside of Christ, you are under the wrath of God. But from a human standpoint of view, many Muslims love the West, love the values, and etc. and so on. But can they also love the West and Western civilization and things like that? Of course, there are problems with Western civilization, but I'm talking about the violent subjugation and overthrow which the Quran, the Hadith, the Sirah, all the Muslim literature calls for. And one of the pillars of Islam is to follow the Prophet Muhammad and to basically live like he did. Churchill goes on to state that, but their influence of their religion paralyzes the social development of those who follow it. No stronger retrograde force exists in the world. Far from being morbid, Mohammedanism is a militant and proselytizing faith. It has already spread through Africa and talks about the spread of it. And in another place, he says, and he notes about Wahhabianism on, this is, I'll just give you a bit of a quote, I'm going to quote here from, this is Peter Hammond's book on Islam, but Churchill noted the threat of Wahhabianism on June 14th, 1921, at the House of Commons. At the time, Churchill was secretary for the British colonies, and he had been involved in the formation of Iraq in 1921, Jordan, Transjordan, and Palestine territories which Britain had liberated from the Ottoman Empire. Now, modern-day Turkey. So, a large number of Bin Saad's followers belonged to the Wahhabi sect, a form of Mohammedanism. He states, this is Churchill now, the Wahhabis profess a life of exceeding austerity, and this is the religion of Saudi Arabia, and what they practice themselves, they rigorously enforce on others. They hold it as an article of duty as well of faith to kill all who do not share their opinions and to make slaves of their wives and children. Women have been put to death in Wahhabi villages for simply appearing in the streets. Austere, intolerant, well-armed, and bloodthirsty in their own regions, the Wahhabis are a distinct factor which must be taken into account, and they have been and still are very dangerous to the holy cities of Mecca and Medina. And he also said that an appeaser is one who feeds the crocodile hoping it will eat him last. So this is Churchill talking about Theresa May. If she's being genuine, I do believe that there are other examples other than Hillary and Bill Clinton who have been working for the Saudis. I'm not saying only working for the Saudis. They basically work for whoever will pay them to do their bidding. They're paid for hire. The Saudis give money, and this is on record, to the Clinton Foundation, a so-called charity. But just say Theresa May is being genuine here, and we must always give people the benefit of the doubt. Churchill said, an appeaser is one who feeds the crocodile, hoping it will eat him last. Victory will never be found by taking the line of least resistance. So that is, I'm not saying Winston Churchill was perfect or that we should follow his example, but necessarily on everything. But look how much Britain has changed. People talk about British values and all this kind of thing. What does it mean anymore? It's meaningless. Would Churchill's views be welcome in Britain today? Of course they would not. And they wouldn't be welcome in America. They wouldn't be welcome in Britain. Let's continue with this is 20 minutes into Theresa May's speech.
If we do not act, we risk sleepwalking into a society in which crime can no longer be investigated and terrorists can plot their murderous schemes undisrupted. We have to give the police and the security services the powers they need to keep us safe, and that is what the next Conservative government will do.
You know, how would I put it? Why should we give a government more and more power, just a little aside, when they don't recognize what the problem is? You look at the media, and the media keeps reporting every time there's a person brandishing a machete or driving a truck or whatever, massacring people in Europe and saying and shouting Allah Akbar, which is Arabic for God is Allah is greater or something like that. And every time they say that, that's what Muhammad and his followers would do, you know, to strike terror into the hearts of any of the tribes they're fighting against. That they can't recognize the issue and won't call it what it is. Why would you give them more power?
So we must give ourselves the legal powers and technical capabilities we need to protect the public. But we will not prevail against the terrorist threat through military strength or counter-terrorism powers alone. We need to defeat the ideology that lies behind the threat. The extremists believe in a clash of civilizations, a fundamental...
So, I agree, Theresa May. I agree here. Let's deal with the ideology. Is she going to deal with the ideology?
...incompatibility between Islamic and Western values, an inevitable divide between them and us. They demand a caliphate or a new Islamic state governed by a harsh interpretation of Sharia law. They utterly reject British and Western...
Whoa. A harsh interpretation of Sharia law? Can... I know, there are some differences. They say that... Experts would say that between the various schools of Islam, there are differences. But there's about a 75% agreement on all... major issues. To be honest, it gets to the point where there's certain issues, if you don't agree with them on, they'll say you're not even a Muslim. As, you know, the issue with Nabil Qureshi and Ahmadi Muslims, because they believe that there was another prophet after Muhammad. Believe very much the same things, and you could even show that they're, basically long and short, is they're very strict about it. This whole thing of, well, you know, ISIS and all these other groups, they don't represent Islam over and over. They just don't understand it like us Westerners do. All these people, for example, this man here, he doesn't have a clue what it is. Musab Hasan Youssef, who was the son of, one of the founders, the seven founders of Hamas, and one of the founders of Hamas, is a cleric. His son was a double agent, working for the Israelis, working for and he was a Palestinian. He wrote this book, Son of Hamas, was a New York Times bestseller. I'm sure he doesn't know what he's talking about either, having grown up in it, and was disgusted by it when he saw these Muslims basically, you know, torturing their own. But here's what he says about Islam. And he's come out of it since. Now, I don't know, how credible his profession of faith is. To be honest, it doesn't sound very credible. I pray that I'm wrong. Pray that he does know Christ. But anyway, so many in the West who stereotype all Muslims as terrorists don't know about the side of Islam that reflects love and mercy. It cares for the poor, widows, and orphans. It facilitates education and welfare. It unites and strengthens. This is the side of Islam that motivated those early leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood. I think it's a... No, just a little aside, I think his view is a little naive. It's kind of like people in on this island, people who come from Republican backgrounds who would have been very sympathetic, or families would have been involved with the IRA, terrorist groups who would have killed women and children, and for a while, sometimes the rose tinted glass, even sometimes, you know, they weren't Christians before and they got saved, and then little by little they renounce it, but sometimes you can have rose-tinted glasses about certain things that were done. Terrorist groups are never, ever to be sympathized with. And Christians who are involved in that need to repent. He says, of course, there is also the other side, the one that calls all Muslims to jihad, to struggle and to contend with the world until they establish a global caliphate led by one holy man who rules and speaks for Allah. This will be important for you to understand and to remember as we go along. And he goes through a lot of the history and stuff like that. Now, I think there's a lot of truth in what he's saying. I don't think everybody involved in Islam is a blood... Okay. From a biblical point of view, from a spiritual point of view, we're all dead in trespasses and sins. But there's that old saying of the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Our greatest deeds, Our most noble deeds are but filthy rags. So the problem is that, how would I put it? I'll just quote, I got a quote from Mossab Hassan Youssef. And this is the problem. A lot of them go in with quote-unquote good intentions. They're probably very nice. They could have various backgrounds. Some of them could be doctors. Some of them could be party animals. You could have these 18, 19, 20-year-olds. They're going out drinking and whatever else. Basically not living as a Muslim. Then feel guilty. They believe this thing with their head. You know, they go to the mosque and all that. But during the week, you know, they're... Eventually, they're going to get to a point, a lot of these people, oh, I'm in trouble. However, the Quran and the Hadith, I think it's in Sayyid Abakari, and I've quoted this in another show, the show I did with the Islamic invasion in Europe, which promises for those who die in jihad, can't remember the exact number of the Hadith, but in the Hadith, it talks about, there's like two options. If you die in jihad, then you're guaranteed to go to heaven. If you don't, you just get the war booty. And a lot of these people aren't sure if they've committed shirk. Shirk can be included, kind of almost guarantees you go to hell, from what I understand of it. You know, ascribing partners to Allah. You know, if you said Jesus is God, that would be unacceptable. In Islam, because one of the most condemned things in the Quran is, maybe the most condemned thing is what it calls adding partners to Allah. Okay, in page 11 of Mossab Hassan Youssef's book, he said, Islamic life is like a ladder, with prayer and praising Allah as the bottom rung. The higher rungs represent helping the poor and needy, establishing schools and supporting charities. And I worked for Muslims before, and I think a lot of them were probably on that part of it. I don't know. We don't know people's hearts. They're probably, a lot of these people saying it to us, that Islam is a religion of peace. I'm sure a lot of them think that they're helping the world. However, as Mossab Hassan Youssef said, the highest rung is jihad. He said, the ladder is tall, few look up to see what is at the top. The progress is usually gradual, almost imperceivable, like a barn cat stalking a swallow. He goes on, with that kind of analogy. He says, traditional Muslims stand at the foot of the ladder, living in guilt for not really practicing Islam. At the top are fundamentalists, the ones you see in the news killing women and children for the glory of the God of the Quran. Moderates are somewhere in between. A moderate Muslim is actually more dangerous than a fundamentalist. I found this comment astonishing when I was reading this book. Read this book a long time ago. I'm doing a lot of research at the moment on Islam, but I was here and there doing bits of research on Islam, but what's happening in Europe, in Sweden, Germany, I felt that I had to spend more time covering this issue because the media refuses to do it, and actually anybody who does try and cover it is lambasted by either CNN, MSNBC, whoever else. He said, a moderate Muslim is actually more dangerous than a fundamentalist, however, because he appears to be harmless and you can never tell when he has taken the next step towards the top. Most suicide bombers begin as moderates. And I don't know, you can get all the sorts of quotes, there's no such thing as a moderate. Look, it's a false religion. There's going to be lots of different interpretations in various areas. But there are pillars of Islam, and there are things, there are guideposts outside. You cannot go outside, to which the Sunni and the Shias and all these other groups will say, if you go outside of these pillars of Islam, you're not a Muslim. Let's continue with Theresa May's speech.
Values, including democracy, the rule of law, and equality between citizens, regardless of their gender, ethnicity, religion, or sexuality. They believe that it is impossible to be a good Muslim and a good British citizen. And they dismiss anybody who disagrees with them, including other Muslims, as a non-believer. This hateful ideology has nothing to do with Islam.
So the problem is, let's get ahead of this here. The problem is you're misunderstanding Islam and ISIS. You're all wrong. You just need to go back to the Muslim sources and study Muhammad and you'll be okay. Sadly, she's mistaken.
Itself.
So does she deal with the actual problem? The actual problem being, Islam. No. Says, no, there's a bunch of these nutcases out in the Middle East, and they don't get Islam. All these people. They don't get Islam. All these countries, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Pakistan, etc. They don't get Islam. Okay, they don't completely agree on how they apply Sharia. But they all believe the Sharia and the Prophet Muhammad is to be emulated.
And it is rejected by the overwhelming majority of Muslims in Britain and around the world. The Quran says, O mankind, we created you from a single pair of a male and a female, and made you into nations and tribes that ye may know each other. It says, let there be no compulsion in religion. So let this message go out from this hall, that the extremists will never...
I'm not sure where the first part of the quote comes from necessarily, but the let there be no compulsion in religion is said in Surah 2:256, which says, let there be no compulsion in religion. Truth stands out clear from error. Whoever rejects Tagat and believes in Allah hath grasped the most trustworthy handhold that never breaks, and Allah heareth and knoweth all things. Anyway, so it appears there's no compulsion in religion. One thing, there's a couple of things about the Quran. Quran is not chronological. It's kind of a bit all over the place. It's a bit confusing, to be honest. And there's different stages and different battles in Muhammad's life to which he gets whatever it is, demonic visitations, whatever you want to put on it. He gets these revelations, or whether he's a complete con artist, I do not know. Doesn't matter, really, for this study. But I just want to quote here what Robert Spencer says here. If I can get the quotation. So, one of the problems here, actually what I'll do first is, oh, here we go. Okay. So, I'll just quote here from Robert Spencer. Now, Robert Spencer, I've been looking through a lot of his research. He seems to be really good. From a secular point of view, I'm not saying so far I've not any of the things have been accused against him. I've never seen him go off in any strange direction from a scholarly point of view. Same with David Wood in Acts 17 Apologetics. I have aired some concerns about Acts 17 Apologetics from a Christian point of view and how they present the gospel and their weakness, I would put it, in the direction of Roman Catholicism. But be that as it may, I think they're still very good for studying Islam. Now, so he talks about the part in the Quran which says that there's no compulsion in religion. It says here, in this, and this is page 100 in his book, The Truth of Muhammad, in this, Muhammad quoted part of what today is most famous verse in all the Quran, Surah 2:256, which contains the maxim, there is no compulsion in religion. The concept of fortunes of the Jews in Arabia, however, indicate that the verse was not considered, even in Muhammad's day, to be an open-ended invitation of religious pluralism and a call to Muslims to coexist peacefully as equals with non-Muslims. You look at the history of the period, it was not taken like that. And it's also, we're looking in a second, There is also a principle in the Quran which states that previous revelation is done away with in favor of recent revelation. Surah 2, 106 states, "Whatsoever verse we shall abrogate or cause thee to follow, we will bring a better than it and one like unto it. Dost thou not know that God is Almighty?" Surah 16, 101. When we substitute one revelation for another, and God knows best what he reveals in stages, they say, "Thou art but a forger," and most of them understand not. Basically, most recent revelation abrogates what's there. I think one of the debates about is it possible to reform Islam. Now, if we're Christians, we should realize that is a futile task. Why? Because it's a false religion. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. We all are sinners, every single one of us, regardless of our background. We all need to be washed in the blood of the Lamb. There's only one way unto the Father. Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me." There's no other way. No other way. But there's a bit of a debate about reforming and all this kind of stuff in Islam. You know, the peaceful verses, the early part when they were in Mecca before they moved to Medina. There are some more peaceful sounding verses, and there's some covenants and agreements that are brought about, but later these are abrogated. See, because the reformers, very few of these voices around, will say, well, we need to go the opposite way around. We'll go through the first ones first, interpret the more violent ones later. I think that's what people like Robert Spencer are hoping for, that Islam will undergo some kind of a reformation, that it will be more peaceful. However, the Quran and the entire Muslim world is basically going, no, the later revelation and the later ones are not saying, let there be no compulsion in religion. Just going to continue on with Theresa May's speech before we continue with any more comments.
Ever succeed in dividing us. Let the message go out that we know Islam is a religion of peace and it has nothing to do with the ideology of our enemies. Let us stand. And let us stand side by side with the British Muslims who are coming together and saying, "Not in my name."
Okay, you know, there's various technicalities with, okay, you could say prior revelations, after revelations, things like that. So, it astonishes me that people go, oh, look, here's a peaceful sounding surah. And there's other ones as well. There's one or two other ones. Don't have them in front of me here, but... oh, I think I'd have it here, actually. It's also... oh, yeah. Surah 109, verse 6. "You shall have your religion, and I shall have my religion." There's a couple of stories I have in front of me here. There's a lot of deception. Often misquoting the Quran. Verses that may look like when they're chopped up into pieces, and not giving the full context, may sound peaceful. But at the end of it, you're like, no, that's not. Now, for example, CNN quoted, this is a quote from CNN. "Most of the world's 1.57 billion Muslims know that the Holy Quran states that clearly, quote, anyone who kills a human being," and there's a big dot, 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 because there's a lot of left out, "it shall be taught as if he killed all of mankind. Anyone who saves a life, it shall be as though he was saved the lives of all mankind." However, that quote from CNN, this is back in 2009, from a piece written by Arzalan Iftikhar, in an article called "Murder Has No Religion," However, the Quran, Surah 5, 32-33, states something completely different. For this reason, that we prescribe that the children of Israel, no, it's the children of Israel, it's not to Muslims, that whosoever slays a soul, unless it be for manslaughter or for mischief in the land. Boom. Straight away. And this is, first, is given to the children of Israel. It's not given to the Muslims. Number two, it gives stipulations. It says, whoever kills a soul, this is always slain all mankind. Can't murder unless manslaughter. Mischief in the land. And as we know from a lot of leftist media, who's doing mischief in the land? According to Islam, the rights and wrongs of the different wars. The guy didn't agree with them, the decision to go into Iraq, all that kind of thing, Afghanistan, whatever. But that is seen in Islam as mischief in the land. Ron Paul, when he was going for the presidency back in 2008, talked about, I think there's a book written by a former CIA officer, anyway, it was called Blowback. And there's a certain level of truth to it, a certain level of truth to it. Of, you're going to radicalize them by getting involved there, because they're just going to hate you more. That's a certain level of that. But the hateful ideology is already in the Quran. It's already in Hadith. The Hadith, now, just for those who are not aware, Hadith are collections, often collected hundreds of years after Muhammad. They're supposed to be sayings of Muhammad. What Muhammad said, and their traditions handed down orally. Eventually, it was a lot of what we call fake ahadith. Ahadith is plural of hadith. And they would eventually get collections of these to, you know, weed out which ones are fake, which ones are whatever. Whether they're real or not, it's kind of immaterial at this point, because the point is the Muslim world believes it. You have the Quran, and then you have the Hadith collection, for example, the big collections, like 9 volumes is one. One's called Sahih al-Bukhari. That's the most, it's like number 2 after the Quran. It's not seen as being perfect, like the way Muslims will view the Quran, but it's seen as being authoritative, because, look, you read through the Quran, a lot of it is missing context, it can be interpreted different ways depending on the context, and this is where the Hadith comes in. It fills in the gaps and tells you about the different battles, and it shares extra information that is needed when the Quran is extremely vague. Anyway, so Theresa May says that it's a religion of peace. There's a couple of things that have to be dealt with here. Our view is a very common view, sadly. So, the first argument, I'm going to try and deal with this one by one, that it has nothing to do with Islam. The source texts say otherwise. Now, there's all this thing, well, why is there peaceful verses? There's a thing known as the 3 stages of jihad. Depends on where the Muslims are. If they're a persecuted minority like they were in Mecca, or if they were in what's called defensive jihad, so in stage 2, or stage 3 if they're a majority. And then this is where the peaceful stuff kind of goes out the window, when in Surah 9:29 states, fight those who believe not in Allah nor the last day, nor hold that forbidden which has been forbidden by Allah and His Messenger, nor acknowledge the religion of truth from among the people of the book until they pay jizya with willing submission and feel themselves subdued. Okay? I don't want to skip through it too much. I'm going to read some hadith in a second, but Surah 2, 190, verse 190, and this is the amazing thing, is it's in the same. If you're going to compare the peaceful-sounding ones to the more aggressive and violent, the aggressive violent outnumber the so-called peaceful ones, and they're never interpreted like Theresa May does. Yeah, you may get some liberal one, you know, these kind of people who are in the West, loving the West and enjoying life, freedom and all this kind of thing, don't wear hijab, but still have warm feelings when they go on holiday back to maybe their family lives in Iran, Iraq, wherever. Well, maybe not Iraq, but they're, you know, the first, the second, third generation Muslims who were from the Middle East, etc., but have kind of rose into the glasses about that, or they're lying about it. Who knows? Now, in Surah 2, 190, says, fight in the cause of Allah those who fight you. Now, this is a little bit different. You say there's no compulsion of religion. I think this is more stage 2, where fight those who fight you, more defensive jihad. I think that's more what's going on in the West, to say, oh, look, they're in Muslim lands and all this kind of stuff. But do not transgress limits, for Allah loveth not transgressors, 191, and slay them wherever you catch them. Slay them wherever. And turn them out from where they turned you out. For persecution is worse than slaughter, but fight them not at the sacred mosque unless they first fight you there. But if they fight you, slay them. In large part, it's just resistance to Islam. Such is the reward of those who reject faith. But if they cease, Allah is oft forgiving, most merciful. And fight them on until there is no more persecution, and the religion becomes Allah's. And if they cease, let there be no more hostility except to those who practice oppression. And if we see the victim complex that is often seen by Muslim apologists, nothing new here. And it's, you know, blame the West and always claim that they're unprovoked. Just want to read a comment here from Robert Spencer's book. And it's like, after jihadist strikes in Iraq or Israel, jihad warriors treat any countermeasures by America or Israeli forces as unprovoked attacks, deserving swift and fierce revenge. So, and also another comment he makes on, where are we there? So it's 121. And this goes back to battles that Muhammad would have fought. But with the displacement of responsibility unto the enemy, that would become characteristic of jihad warriors throughout the ages. Muhammad told the Muslims, quote, the Jews have declared war, unquote. Allah gave him a revelation, assuring him that the hypocrites proved just as false as the Jews as they had to Muhammad. These are people who were saying that they would go fight and they abandoned later. Robert Spencer goes on to comment that he promised the prophet of Israel, no, sorry, Islam, sorry, victory over Nadir. And he, had he not delivered victory over those who, quote, lately preceded them. So anyway, long and short, there's a whole history that goes back of blaming the other side. It's not unique to them, but you make it look like, well, they hit us first. Even often the case, it is not the case. Especially if, you know, there's countermeasures or anything like that. Okay. So, where are we going to next? So we dealt with, is it a religion of peace? It's easy to refute. We want to go Sahih al-Bukhari, and I remember saying that, remember I said that this is the most recognized, the most trusted collection of hadith, a hadith. It says in Surah, or Sahih al-Bukhari 6924, Muhammad said, I have been ordered to fight the people till they say, La ilallah ilallah. Don't know how to pronounce that exactly. None has the right to be worshipped but Allah, and whosoever say, La ilallah ilallah, Allah will save his property and his life from me. Sounds very peaceful. Sahih Muslim. This is another collection of hadith. This is like 7 volumes, if I'm not mistaken. Sahih Bukhari is like 9 volumes. Says, Muhammad said, I have been commanded to fight against people so long as they do not declare that there is no God but Allah. And it also talks about how to treat Muslims. I just want to go back to the Quran a bit. There's some ones, I mean, which ones do you pick? Surah 9, 13 and 14. Again, these are different stages. Often they seem contradictory, but there is a system that's kind of been worked out over the years. Now, they interpret these things. It talks about in Surah 9:5. These verses, of course, Theresa May and other Islamic apologists don't like to look at. But when the forbidden months are passed, then fight and slay the pagans wherever you find them and seize them. So that's that verse. Not the complete verse, but you get the picture of it. 13 to 16, I'll read all of this. Will ye not fight people who violate their oaths, plotting to expel the messenger and attack you first? Do ye fear them? Nay, it is Allah, whom ye should more justly fear if ye believe. Fight them, and Allah will punish them by your hands and disgrace them, help you to victory over them, heal the breasts of believers, and still the indignation of their hearts, for Allah will turn in mercy to whom he will, and Allah is all-knowing, all-wise. Do you know that you would be left alone while Allah has not yet known those among you who strive and might and main and take none for friends and protectors except Allah? So don't take friends and protectors. Verse 29 says, fight those who believe not in Allah. What else? Verse 29. Yeah, this is all I really wanted to quote here. And the last part there I want to look at. Show how peaceful it is. Sahih Muslim 4:43-66. Muhammad said, I will expel the Jews and Christians from the Arabian Peninsula. I will not leave any but Muslim. Very acceptable, very tolerant, shall we say. Surah 98, verse 6. Those who reject truth among the people of the book, that's Christians, and among the polytheists, that's the pagans of Arabia at the time, the Arabian Peninsula, will be in hellfire to dwell therein. They are the worst of creatures. Christians are the worst of creatures. Talks about one part that I think it's Surah 551. The references might be a little bit different here because I'm going to a few different different translations, but the translation I'm mainly using for this is Abdullah Yusuf Ali's, and it's kind of the one that's seen like the quote-unquote King James of the translations of the Quran. Surah 551, at least in this translation I have in front of me, it's not Yusuf Ali's, but that Muslims are the best of creatures. And the Quran talks about not taking the Christians and the Jews for friends, because they are the worst of creatures. Now, does every Muslim believe this? No, I don't believe this. Every professing Muslim. How we define that is another issue. Now, is it a force for good? Now, the other point they were going through, as Theresa May mentioned, was, okay, she says it has nothing to do with the Quran. That's false. Provably, easily false. I could go through many, many more quotations. It is easily proven to be false. Another thing she said was, I don't remember the exact, don't want to misquote it here, that the vast, vast majority of Muslims don't hold these views. And now, and the thing about it is, I agree, the vast majority of Muslims don't hold these views. However, a disturbingly high amount, it's not a tiny minority, a disturbing amount of Muslims hold to very, very, what we would call extremist views. An ICM poll, 20%, this is back after the London 7/7 bombings, said 20% of British Muslims sympathize with 7/7 bombers. NOP research, this is from a number of years ago as well, this is back in 2006, 1 in 4 British Muslims say 7/7 bombings were justified. Channel 4 in 2006, 31% of younger British Muslims say 7/7 bombings were justified compared to 14% of those over 45. So those over 45, it's disturbing that there's 14% of those over 45. But of the younger ones, the younger Muslims, 31%. So if you have, statistically speaking, if you have 10 British Muslims, and notice, British Muslims we're talking about here, not Pakistani, not Saudi Arabian, not Sudanese, whatever, you're talking about British Muslims, 31% of them said the 7/7 bombings, terrorism, was justified. And that's from the policeexchange.org.uk. People Press, 31% of Turks support suicide attacks against Westerners in Iraq. This is incredible, because you're not talking about small numbers. What is the population of Turkey? 31% of that. 1/3 of Palestinians support the slaughter of a Jewish family, including the children. This is from pjmedia.com. So, we're not talking about one or two researchers. World Public Opinion, 83% of Egyptians approve the attacks on American troops. 26% of Indonesians approves the attacks on American troops. 26% of Pakistanis. 68% of Moroccans. 90% of Palestinians approve of attacks on American troops. 90% of Palestinians. It's amazing, because if you look, remember there was a European, anybody follow European football or anything like that? Glasgow Celtic, I think they might have gotten in trouble with UEFA over this, had flags of the Palestinians, you know, like, and everybody thought this is wonderful. Is this the same Palestinians who voted in Hamas? Bloodthirsty terrorist group that wants Israel wiped off the map, by the way. Doesn't want a two-state solution. Does not want it. Yeah, Yasser Arafat, he was seen as a traitor, by the way, by Musab Hassan Youssef. Wasn't really part of the cause at all, but be that as it may. This is astonishing. 72% of Jordanians support attacks on American troops. 52% of Turks. Something a bit more recent, maybe. 16% of young Muslims in Belgium, state terrorism is acceptable. Or in Belgium, state terrorism is acceptable. Pew Research, a bit more mainstream, shall we say, 26% of young Muslims in America believe suicide bombers are justified. 26%. How many of these people, you see, it's not the easiest thing. Somebody, I don't know how exactly these surveys are done, but what do you do? Do you give them a sheet or, yeah, I think most, it must be anonymous, but 26% in America believe suicide bombings are justified. 35% of young Muslims in Britain believe suicide bombers are justified. Now, you talk about young Muslims now, 24% overall. 42% of young Muslims in France, 22% of young Muslims in Germany, 29% of young Muslims in Spain. You're talking about millions of people who sympathize with somebody who straps bombs to his body and believe and shouts Allah Akbar, whatever else it is, and blows up women and children. Pew Research in 2011, 8% of Muslims in America believe suicide bombings are often or sometimes justified. That is scary. Whatever the, okay, it's a minority, But we're talking not a minority of a small, niche, tiny group. We're talking about millions of people. Where are they getting this from? They're getting it from the Quran. They're getting it from the life of Muhammad. Are we going to be cowards and say nothing? Oh, just don't. I heard somebody the other day, right? Ugh. Just don't anger them. Don't annoy them. I remember I think the whole thing about the whole burkini thing is so stupid, to be honest. Again, it's not dealing with the actual issue. But be that as it may. What else has happened in the West? A disturbing trend, and I hope to go through this here if time permits. Again, all this is coming from the Muslim sources. We're trying to remain faithful to the Muslim sources by the grace of God. In Sharia, according to the Quran, says in Surah 2, 282, call in two male witnesses from among you, but if two men cannot be found, and one man and two women, whom you judge fit to act as witnesses, and if either of them commit an error, the other will remain. Now, what you have here is the testimony of women in Islamic Sharia courts is half of that of a man. So there needs to be how do I put it here? Because of the way you need lots of witnesses to prove against, and often there isn't any witnesses. That's why there's so many rapes that go unpunished. Islamic legal theorists, Robert Spencer writes in his book about Muhammad, have restricted women's testimonies even further, limiting to it. In other words, one Muslim legal manual cases involves property and transactions dealing with property such as sales, unquote. Otherwise, only men can testify. So, okay, women are worth half of that, but they can't testify in other cases. Spencer goes on to write, consequently, it is even today virtually impossible to prove rape in lands that follow the dictates of the Sharia. Unscrupulous men can commit rape with impunity as long as they deny the charge and there is no witnesses, they get off scot-free because the victim's account is inadmissible. Even worse, if a woman accuses a man of rape, she may end up incriminating herself. It is required, if the required male witnesses can't be found, male witnesses. Not female witnesses, male witnesses. The victim's charge of rape becomes an admission of adultery. That accounts for the charge of rape because it becomes it. That accounts for the grim fact that as many as 75% of the women in prison in Pakistan are in fact behind bars for a crime of being a victim of rape. Several high-profile cases in Nigeria recently have also revolved around rape accusations being turned around by Islamic authorities into charges of fornication, resulting in death sentences that are only modified after the internal pressure. And it's a massive, massive problem. Another thing I want to talk to you about as well, highlighted in this very, very good book. Quran 4:24 talks about those whom your right hand possesses. It allows for sexual intercourse with slave girls. Supposed to encourage Muhammad's followers booty had to be given. And women and children were part of that booty. Even to the point where some have reported that some were captured war captives. The previous marriage to whoever it is annulled. So, says here that, and I'm going to quote from Abu Saad, explained, we decide that having sexual course with them, just going to skip over, it's a bit disgusting. It does not mean, of course, I'll leave that out, to be honest. The Muslim sources, just to summarize, because it give you a lot of quotations here, maybe too much here, I recommend getting this book. It's really good, The Truth About Muhammad by Robert Spencer. Everything I've fact-checked so far seems to carry out, but if anybody has any issues with anything I've quoted, maybe out of not exactly correct, email me, miguelofilms@gmail.com. But it talks about taking wives, children, and property as booty. War captives. Slaves. One part that's recorded in the part of the Spoils of Khaybar, he said, it's quoted here that one of the Muslim warriors said, oh, Allah's Prophet, give me a slave girl from the captives. And what did Muhammad say? Go and take any slave girl. Now, there's a whole transaction later on where Muhammad changes his mind and takes the woman for himself because she's quite attractive. Apostates are to be killed. If you, this is a wonderful, tolerant religion. Didn't anybody tell you? You can beat your wife. That is supported by Hadith, and that is supported by the Quran itself. Again, we don't have time to go through it here, but Lord willing, there'll be other times to go through it because there's just too much to go through. There is a doctrine in Islam that you can take wives and children, part of the war booty. Now, the Quran calls for the stoning of those who committed adultery. Yes, it does. But it allows for stipulations outside of that. There's Quran 4:24, in which it says, whom your right hand possesses. Some of these cases have been recorded in various Islamic countries. For example, and some of the out, because a woman's testimony is worthless in Islamic court, I might as well say it's worthless, excuse me, and they're not treated as humans. For example, The Economist reported on the 20th of March 2004 that there were women setting themselves alight, on fire. The Economist reports, Malali Nurzi had been thrashed by her mother-in-law once too often. She headed sobbing to the kitchen, poured petrol on herself. And apparently this is a regular phenomenon. BBC News Online reported the story of Rania Al-Baz, who allowed newspapers to show pictures of her swollen, disfigured face and highlight the domestic abuse in Saudi Arabia. Rania and her husband, Mohammed Al-Falata, beat her so hard that he broke her nose. So there's beating in there. It's a wonderful religion. Quote, they said that it is considered a husband's right that his wife should obey him and can involve coercion or violence, and we know that the majority of cases of this kind go unreported and unnoticed. And again, there's kind of a pattern of blaming the victim. As what happened in Cologne. Remember those, I don't know, some like hundreds and hundreds of sexual assaults, rapes across Germany. And an imam dealt with it a couple, you know, basically blamed the victims. Said, well, you know, they weren't covering themselves enough, even though it's quite cold and probably wearing a jacket. So there's this commonality of victimhood, blaming others for their actions. This report states that Prince of Honor, Muslim woman, lift the veil on the silence of the Muslim world. Jan Goodwin reported that working women in Cairo have complained of being sexually assaulted by buses of men who take the opportunity to knead, rob, and fondle female commuters. Since being manhandled, it is so shameful to report decent women suffer in silence rather than be accused of having encouraged the man. And as we saw earlier, they can be accused of adultery and go to prison or be stoned to death. Of course, they don't come forward. Let's look at Sweden. Sweden, mass migration of Muslims into Sweden. Most of them, if you look at the pictures and you go by the pictures, are, not all of them, by the way, but most of them are men of military age. This is serious, folks. This is coming near you. And if you believe the propaganda, you are letting down your women and children. The men and those researchers and those who are in journalism and those who are in the media and those who have any influence, you need, there's a problem with my camera there, you need to stand up and declare the truth as much as you see it. Sweden and Denmark have the highest number of sexual assaults in Europe. This is reported by the UK Independent. No, this is not from a rabidly anti-Islamic group. This is from the European Agency for Fundamental Rights. That's the Independent. Gatestone Institute reports that Sweden, rape capital of the West, and I think both of these authors are Swedish. Sweden has become the rape capital of the West. It reports 40 years after the Swedish Parliament unanimously decided to change the formerly homogenous Sweden into a multicultural country, violent crimes has increased by 300% and rapes by 1,472%. Sweden is now numbered 2 on the list of rape countries, surpassed only by Lesotho in southern Africa. Now the source here is from, it's actually from a Swedish source from what I can see. I don't speak Swedish. This is the Ingrid Karlvist, if I'm pronouncing her name properly, is Swedish. Violent crime is increased by 300%. But that's racist! That's not all Muslims, and we're not saying it's all Muslims. But we're saying Islam has a problem. I want to play a clip here. This is from, before we finish up the show, this is from CBS. This is of a very, very sad case. This is from a woman by the name of Lara Logan. She was reporting in Cairo a number of years ago. And she saw firsthand, sadly, what is a common feature in the Islamic world.
Mubarak was falling. More than 100,000 people filled. The night of February 11th, the Egyptian dictatorship of Hosni Mubarak was falling. More than 100,000 people filled Cairo's Tahrir Square in wild celebration. Among those in the crowd was our 60 Minutes colleague, correspondent Laura Logan. Laura, a native of South Africa, is an experienced war reporter, but Tahrir Square became her most hazardous assignment. During the revolution, dozens of reporters were assaulted, often by agents of the regime. The night of the 11th, a mob turned on Laura and her 60 Minutes team and singled her out in a violent sexual assault. Since then, Laura has been recuperating with her husband and two children. Now, she's returning to work, and she's decided to tell the story of what happened just once here on our broadcast. She's speaking out, she tells us, to add her voice to those who confront sexual violence, to break what she calls the code of silence. Laura Logan arrived in Cairo at a moment of triumph for Egypt. She didn't imagine in the hours before midnight she would be fighting for her life.
The story will continue in a moment.
When we drove from the airport into Cairo that night, moments after Mubarak had stepped down, it was unbelievable. It was like unleashing a champagne cork on Egypt. I'm anxious to get to the square. I got to be there because this is a moment in history that you don't want to miss.
What does it look like?
It looks like a party. It's a roar of sound because everyone's so excited and they're singing songs of the revolution and they're shouting slogans. And everybody's, you know, very physical. So you're being jostled and pushed, and sometimes people get closer, and my guys are very protective. It's, you know, they want to keep people at bay. It was impossible not to get caught up in the moment, which was a real moment of celebration.
Tell me about your team.
Our producer was Max McClellan. My cameraman was Richard Butler.
Baha works for us.
We had a local fixer, Baha, whose job was to bridge the divide for us as foreigners. We had two Egyptian drivers with us who were purely there to act as security and bodyguards. And then we had a security person, Ray, who's done security all over the world.
This is what these people have been waiting for. They came here day after day. This is about freedom.
She reported without a hint of trouble for more than an hour.
And what happened then?
Our camera battery went down. And we had to stop for a moment, and suddenly Baha looks at me and says, "We've got to get out of here."
Baha is not happy here.
He's Egyptian, he speaks Arabic, and he can hear what the crowd is saying.
Yes.
He understands what no one else in the crew understands.
That's right. I was told later that they were saying, "Let's take her pants off." And it's like suddenly, before I even know what's happening, I feel hands grabbing my breasts.
Okay, so there's no need to play any more of that. What happened to her was horrendous. This happened a number of years ago. Sadly, this is not unique. This is not a one-off. In Sahih Muslim 3371, it sanctions rape of captive women. I'm just going to quote part of Sahih Muslim. It says, "We went out of Allah's messenger, may peace be upon him, on the expedition to Bil Mustaqwi, and took captives some excellent Arab women. We desired them, for we were suffering from the absence of our wives, but at the same time, we also desired ransom for them. So we decided to have sexual intercourse with them by observing..." Yeah. So I'm not going to quote that. You can probably... Anyway. So, but we just going to skip on just a little bit. For those who are a bit, you know. "But we said we are doing an act, whereas Allah's messenger is amongst us. Why not ask him? So we asked Allah's messenger, may peace be upon him, and he said, It does not matter if you do not do it, for every soul is to be born to the..." So it doesn't matter. Allah says, it doesn't matter, work away. Or Allah's messenger says, it doesn't matter. So, in Islamic law, umdat al-salik, 09.13, not sure exactly how you reference this, but when a child or a woman is taken captive, they become slaves by the fact of their capture, and the woman's previous marriage is immediately annulled. I was talking about that earlier. Also, Quran 23:1-6, believers must win through and who humble themselves in their prayers, who avoid vain talk, who are active in deeds of charity, who abstain from sex, except with those who join them in the marriage bond, or whom their right hand possess, for they are free from blame. And when you combine what the Quran says, it says you can't do this except for captives whom their right hand possess. That's the language it uses in the Quran. And then you look at the hadith on top of that, and then you look at the behavior in the Middle East and in countries that have seen a mass influx of Islamic immigration. What do you see? Sweden has become the rape capital of the world. Laura Logan's story, who worked with CBS News, is not an isolated incident. But sadly, most women who are raped, violated, never get to testify because of the nature of the Sharia courts. And this is what the leftists want us to support and call peaceful and loving. And these cowards in Sweden, in Germany, and across Europe, who bury the statistics, remove the name Muslim from police reports, in order what? So they won't be labeled racist. Grow a spine. This is more important than your public opinion. We're too late down the road to say nothing. So, and again, is this a minority? Well, it depends what topic it's on. Al Jazeera in 2006. 49.9% of Muslims polled support Osama bin Laden. Is this a tiny, tiny minority? The Clarion Project study. They studied. This is at least 42 million supporters in the Arabic world. 11.5 of our percent of Arabs support ISIS, or 42 million. It says in the report, an analysis of four recent polls surveying Arab public opinion towards the Islamic State. This article is written by Ryan Morrow. Back in 2015, an analysis of four polls surveying Arabic public opinion towards the Islamic State, ISIS and ISIL, reveals that the group has a bare minimum of 8.5 million strong supporters and as a conservative estimate. If you include those who feel somewhat passively towards the Islamic State, the number rises to 42 million. Passively. Do we still think it's a tiny, tiny number? In Sweden, recently, Jihad Watch reports on 40 sexual assaults at music festival, all by Muslim migrants. Just reporting on what happened. So this is the music festival, we are Stockholm, the number of sexual assaults in girls doubled compared to last year. This is reported by Stockholm Police on request of free times and more is yet to come, said police spokesman Mats Erskine. To date, the police received no less than 40 reports of sexual assaults at Stockholm Youth Event. And I was at music festivals years before I was a Christian, and from what I can see, I'm not saying they were done by Muslims, but they're just buried. You don't want to cause a... or bad PR for the music festival. The majority of the victims were between 15 and 17. Breitbart reported back in March, almost half of women are afraid, quote-unquote, to be out after dark in Europe's rape capital. So it's called Scared Sweden. From a Swedish newspaper called Aftonbladen, said, almost every Swedish woman feels very or somewhat unsafe when they exercise alone in the dark. Survey finds that 46% of women aged 16 or over felt either very or somewhat unsafe when they are alone in the dark, compared to just 20% of men. But there's no problem. Religion of peace, it hasn't caused any problems. And what do we have now? This kind of intellectual schizophrenia that has, every time there's a new terrorist attack and another person shouting Allah Akbar, brandishing whatever, killing a lot of the people, and then it's just somebody with psychological problems. Nothing to do with Islam. Raymond Ibrahim writes that as hardly as a few days pass without some Islamic terror attack in the West, recently, and as of this writing of, quote, Allah Akbar shouting, Muslim man stabbed a Jew in France. And Allah Akbar screaming, Muslim woman ran over two policemen in Canada. The West risks becoming desensitized to seeing Islamic violence as just another part of life, and it has become the new norm. And it's easier for people to say and to do nothing. What's the answer to all this? The real answer to ISIS, the real answer to Islamic terrorism, is the gospel of Jesus Christ. Of course, we need security. Of course, we need all those other things. But we need... You see this, the hour we're in? We need more prayer, brethren. We need more prayer. We need the truth. We can't... Lying to ourselves is not going to help us here. Especially if you're in the media. It's not going to help you if you're a Muslim. Lying to yourself. You can recognize all this stuff and just say you become an atheist or whatever else. That, you know, still won't help you. It will not glorify the God of heaven. If you're a Muslim, if you're a leftist, whoever you are, it doesn't matter who you are, you must see you have broken God's law. You have done you have thought things in your mind. If your best friend saw them on a large screen television, they would not even want to talk to you anymore. They would not be your best friend anymore. You have thought things so vile, so wretched, that you're ashamed to even talk about them. God sees that as sin and will be judged on the judgment day. But those who come in repentance and faith to our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ will be forgiven, will have their sins washed away in the blood of the Lamb. For those who see themselves as sinners, there is hope, but there's only hope in Jesus Christ. While we go through many, many disturbing facts, and there's times in life we need to. Be not deceived. The only hope is not in Western values. It's not in exposing Islam. It's in Jesus Christ. And we pray for the day that the glory of the Lord will cover the earth as the waters cover the seas. This has been Paul Flynn. May God bless you all.